Greetings to each one in Jesus' name from Pueblo, Colorado. Been looking forward to coming here for a few months. As I was reflecting on this, I realized that the last time I was in Oregon was when we buried my grandpa Schrock, and that was 20 years ago in May. So that's the last time I've been to here to Oregon, so there's a lot of changes. But there are still some faces that I know, but way more that I don't know. We served in Guatemala for 9 years. 7 years of that time we lived with the people that you... How many here have read the book Awaiting the Dawn? Probably about everybody. We lived with those people that are mentioned in that book, and it's kind of our... I thought it was interesting that John Ray was going to be here at the same time, but not really talking about them or their family. As I lived there with those people and related to them, and actually we lived in the house that the Troyers would have lived in, some of the axe marks and machete marks and bullet holes are still in that house from that eventful night. But as I lived there, the thing that started coming to me, I started hearing snatches of stories, and I realized that there were the native Christians there had faced a lot of things that nobody knows anything about. They suffered in silence, and one reason they did is because if they would have stood up and said anything about it, they would have been killed. And so they have kept those things undercover for years, and you know how it is when something's in there festering, it's good to get it out. It's good to talk about it. And at the same time, some of them wouldn't have been ready to talk for many years. It was 30 years later that some of this happened that I talked to them, and it was still really hard for them to talk about it. And they would burst out, "Lloyd, I never told anybody this before." And so it was a very difficult time, and I was very challenged by the interviews, listening to these people in their interviews. This war in Guatemala lasted for 36 years, 1 month, 2 weeks, and 2 days. If you want to get exact dates, it started in November 13 of 1960 and lasted to December 29 of 1996. And up to 700,000 people died or went missing during that war, including 190,000 to 250 people who just disappeared. Never any record of them. There's no way to count it. But the amazing part about that is that at that time, the population in Guatemala was probably about 9 million. So you're talking about a third of the people disappeared. It would have been about 12 million. So you're... 700,000, that's a big part of the population. So, as I got hearing more and more about this, I got to thinking, you know, I can go to my bookshelf and I can pull a book off that says CO2 status or 1W service, and I can read about these things that my dad, my grandpa, what they did as alternate service in these things and what some of my forefathers stood for. But there's nothing like that in Spanish. There's no books like that for those young people, the next generation coming on in Guatemala. And if you tried to translate those books that we have and give them to them, they'd mean nothing to them. It wouldn't make sense. So my burden was that this stuff be written down and be available to the next generation so they can read it and see what their parents stood for. And if it ever comes up again, they'll have an anchor there. They'll have something to go back to. And this is what my dad did, and this is what I'm going to do. Found it very interesting that as I interviewed some of these older people, that their children would sit in there and listen, and they were just glued, and they said, "Dad, I didn't know that happened to you," or "Mom, I never knew you that happened to you." And these were 25 and 23 and 18-year-old people sitting there. They never heard these stories before. So I was blessed by that as I was interviewing lessons that I learned from this is, number one, in 1 Peter 5:8, it says, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, is a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour." The devil doesn't really care how many people perish when he attacks and tries to destroy God's work or God's people. He doesn't care. Number two, the devil puts things into place to cause great pressure on God's people, pressure to compromise. And as I go through some of this, you'll understand why I have this thought. Not to completely throw out the good and right, not to do complete evil, but to compromise, to go along on the night watch, but maybe not carry a weapon, to just do things to relieve the pressure a little bit from the people around us that are not totally right. Compromise. The devil loves compromise. Number three, the devil will disguise his war against the church as a national war or civil war. The churches in Guatemala were growing at an unbelievable rate when suddenly they were attacked in the name of war. Not by the national government, but by the local authorities that were feeling threatened by the people that were ready to be more loyal to God and His church than to their own village people. The church in Palama lost approximately 50% of her members in a time span of 15 years. And it was because of that pressure. Number four, God will not forsake His children. When faithful ones did stand and did not go out on the patrol, they were threatened with death, burning of homes, persecution, displacement, but they stood firm and God helped them through those times of intense pressure and uncertainty, and He is still helping them today. That was one thing that was very impressive to me, is how those that stood to the test, stood the fire, stood whatever, where they are today and the blessing they are. So we were told a story. There was a man that I'm not even sure how we came to talk to him, but he was a cripple. And because of that, he saw a lot of things. He was not forced into fighting for either side. He was a cripple, and he sat on his porch in his wheelchair, and he saw a lot of things happen in his village and around, and heard a lot of things. And he told us a very interesting story that I don't have the answer. It's just a good introduction to the dilemma that God's people faced. He said there was this village back in the hills that it was a very wooded, closed-in place, and it looked like a place where the guerrillas would hang out, and the army was coming in and just bombing that place. They would just bomb. If there was a brush pile, they bombed it. They're just blowing it up. And all the men had fled from that area and were in hiding because they were after them. And it was just women left in the village and some children, and they would secretly take food out to these men hiding in the caves and in the mountains. And these women, their houses, their whole town, it was just getting blown up. And one day, a woman found a Guatemala flag. And she went and found a sapling out in the woods. And says the women were crying. And they took this sapling and they put this flag up in the town square, up in the air. And when the military planes came in, they saw that flag and they didn't drop any bombs. They flew off again. And later, they came in on the ground to this place and said, "What's going on? What do you want? What is it?" And they explained. They said, "Our men are not against the government, but you're blowing us up. You're annihilating us, and we don't know what to do. We don't have any men to work for us. We barely have food, and what should we do?" And so they were told, "Okay, if you're not opposed to the government, if you're for the government, you get a flag and you put it on the top of your house, or when you walk in the street, you carry a flag in your hand, and you won't be targeted by the military." Well, guess what? That was a target for the guerrillas. The guerrillas didn't have aircraft, but they come in undercover at night and they see a Guatemala flag on a house and they'd throw a hand grenade in the house and blow it up. So either way you did it, you were a target. So what would a Christian do in that situation? What would you do? Would you grab a flag and walk out so the military wouldn't kill you? Or would you go out without a flag and say, and you know, that was the dilemma. if you were not for one side of the fighting, you were by default the other. You could not say, I'm neutral. Nobody would believe you. And so, what should a Christian do in that situation? But in the midst of the confusion and chaos, there were those that took the middle road. They took the middle road, the straight and narrow way, and we want to focus on those men and the choices that they made, those men and women. And I feel very privileged to have personally met some of those faithful men and heard their stories. And to me, they are sacred stories. I want to just give a hypothetical situation, and this was very common. The setting is in the hills of Guatemala, and I don't know how many of you have been there, back in some of those places where it's pretty remote, even today. A lot of them wouldn't even know what you all were talking about yesterday when it comes to technology. And I want to take you away from all this technology, and let's go back into these hills of Guatemala. All the work is done manually. This area has been locked in the grip of idolatry for centuries. One day in the early 70s, some people arrived in this area. They are foreigners. They're light-skinned people. And the priests that condone this idol worship have told the people that these light-skinned people eat Guatemalans. Some don't believe it. These people, these light-skinned people, have a story about a Savior that will bring freedom from the bonds of idolatry. Deep in the forest, in a little dwelling made of adobe and slab wood, an old gentleman with, at the most, a third-grade education is laboriously sounding out the words in a newly acquired Bible. The message of this book has brought joy and peace into this man's life. His hands that are thickly calloused from hours of toil with acordeon and machete tenderly hold the book as he sounds out the words. The only light in the house is what's streaming in through the single window in the one-room house. At night, a candle will be used to provide a little light. The newborn Christian is unaware of the turmoil that is growing in momentum all around him. His life is the same as his dad's and his grandfather lived in the past, growing food for the household, chopping wood for the cook stove, enjoying the good feeling when there is plenty and bearing the pain when there isn't enough to go around. And now this newfound peace and joy in knowing that sins are forgiven and that there is no need to pay money in search for peace. The price has been paid. The words of the Bible are so precious, even though it is a long, painfully slow process to read them. And then one night, as the man is reading the word, he hears some unusual noises outside his house. Suddenly, there's a tremendous bang on his door. And he doesn't know what's going on. Masked men are demanding that he join their ranks and fight for their cause. And he doesn't even know what's going on. Will this man, with his limited education, have the necessary resources to fight the battle? And that's the question I would like to ask you, especially as youth, but everyone here this morning. If it would come to that place here in this country, which it could, would you have the resources? Throw the smartphone out the window, throw the computer out the window, throw everything away. Would you have the resources to fight the battle that that man had to face that day, that night, when those people came to his door? Ephesians 6:12 says, "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places." 2 Corinthians 10:3-4, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds." That man, with his limited education, he had the tool he needed in his hands. That was the Bible, the Word of God. That is the only tool that would fight that battle for him. Three men came from Shekelshold, little men riding on big horses. On the front wall of the Catholic church near Palama, they hung a poster. On the poster, let's say this is a big poster. On the poster up in that corner was a big lion sitting there crouched. And down here in this corner was a little lamb. And that's all the poster had on it. This lamb, said one of the men, is you. Talking to the people there in that church that came to that meeting. The lion is the rich Latinos. They want to devour you. You can let yourself be eaten or you can fight. The authorities are humiliating the Indians more and more. They take our lands and our possessions. They give us no opportunities. They live in fancy houses on good land. They have many possessions while we, the poor, have nothing. Will you just sit back and let it happen? We must rise. We must find weapons. We must fight. And you know, those men knew the strategy it would take to rile up their own people. That's all it took. One of the attendees at the meeting told his sons as they laughed, "That can't be true. If the Latinos had not brought us the acordeon and machete and other things, we would still be harvesting our crops the old way." He didn't believe it. But that man did not mention another modern invention, the gun. Guns were nearly unknown to the people of that area, and a gunshot would have stirred them great fear, would have caused them great fear. Some who attended that meeting, however, felt stirred so strong in hostile action. They felt stirred too strong in hostile action by the guerrilla's words. They cast about for a way to get their hands on that modern invention, the machine gun. most of the killing that went on during that time in those hills had nothing to do with what the government had said was war. It was settling of grudges. It was jealousy. The Indian people hold grudges for generations after generation. If my dad didn't like this person, then I don't either. And finally, they could go settle these grudges. It was sad, very sad. It was pointless, but it was very real. I want to spend some time talking about a family that were very close to us as we lived there. And John Ray would know them as well. Actually, the wife of this family would have been the maid that lived with John's when John was faced his death sentence there. I'm sure that John Ray would remember Emiliana. She was a very good friend of my wife. Her husband Alejandro and I were very good friends. Our family spent quite a bit of time together. And I never knew the story of the things they faced until many years after I learned to know them. I knew that Emiliana was there that night. The Indian people there in Guatemala are kind of a, you might say they're a little timid, a little bashful. I asked Emiliana if she would tell me her life story, and I wished my wife was with me. I knew that would have made it easier for her. It took her a long time to say yes, she would. I asked her if her husband and I sat in their living room if she would just tell me her story. She agreed to it, and when she got started, it was 2 hours later till she got stopped. It was a tremendous story. She grew up Catholic, like most of the people did in those areas. And she said her dad was a very staunch Catholic, but she didn't know that her dad had any vices. He was not a, you might say, an evil man, an ugly man. He was very dedicated to what he knew. And when he became a Christian, he was the same way. He was a very dedicated Christian. He loved the Bible. He could hardly read And their native tongue was not Spanish, it was Caxiquel, which is a Maya language. Her mom didn't read at all, hardly knew Spanish, but her dad, he lived 5 years after he became a Christian, and every day he would get his wife to sit down beside him and he would slowly read through his Bible and explain what the Bible was saying. He had a real desire to know what the Bible was saying and what it meant. That's one of her memories of her dad, and that is a very precious memory to her of her dad sitting there and explaining this Bible. He probably didn't even have a third grade education. He probably taught himself to read. That's the way it was with a lot of people. But as I thought about that, I thought of the verse in Hebrews 4:12 that says, "The word of God is quick and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to dividing asunder soul and spirit, and of the joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart." And that goes for whoever will let that word enter into their hearts. Ecclesiastes 9:11 says, "The wise man said, I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong." Emiliana was 13 when she gave her heart to the Lord, and she felt a real change in her life. She knew her sins were forgiven, and she and her mom, they tried to follow the Lord as the best they could. They joined the church, and after she was baptized, sometime after that, she started to work for John and Marie Troyer. And somewhere in there is when this violence started moving into those back hills. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on that part of the story, although it does have some bearing on the rest of what I like to say, but The deception that the leftists used to get the people to join the cause. She says, "I remember that people came into our village offering help to poor people, cheap clothes, building supplies, but they said, let us have your land titles. We'll take the number of your land title, and then you'll keep receiving this help." And she said, "I don't know where my mom got her wisdom, but she told him, I'm not a crazy woman that is going to sell her property, and you're not going to see my land titles. My husband bought this property, left it for me. He was dead and gone. And I'm going to take good care of it." And you know, later those people came back in and said that we helped you, now you have to join ranks with us. And that was how they forced people into their movement. And this lady, by the grace of God, did not give anything to them, and she was not forced to join them. And I believe there were others that did the same thing. But that was one way that they stood, and God worked in their lives, and they were blessed for it. There were many people that repented later for having given up their titles. Okay, jumping ahead, I don't know how many years. Touch a little bit on the night that John was assassinated from Emiliana's viewpoint and what happened to her during that time. She was there when the people arrived and started beating on the house, and she saw all that take place. And I'm not supposed to quit. Okay. And those men were talking to her a lot. They were talking in the Caxiquel language, and they were telling her that she is deceived. By living with these people, she is deceived. They are taking advantage of her, and they are trying to destroy her and whatever. And she said, that no, they are not doing anything wrong. I know them. I know that they are Christians and they talk about the things of God and so on. They said, no, look at that doghouse back there. That dog lives better than you do. He gets better food. You live in a house with a dirt floor, and that dog has a better house than you do. And they told her, we want to tell you something. Someday you will thank us for what we're doing tonight. But she's never arrived at that point. She never has. And there was one point where she says that there was a gun in her back and she was expecting to die. And she was ready to die. She was not afraid to die. She said, I prayed to God and I committed my life to God. I said, if this is the end of my life, fine. I'm ready to go. I want to be with you. So I was not thinking about my family. I was not thinking about anything but eternity and God. And I thought that was interesting. Now just a little side note here. She was talking about this, and I don't know if John Ray remembers this or not, but after everybody had left and whatever, she went to look for help, and she said, I took John Ray by the hand and took off running for Pablo Cortez's house to get some help. She says, thinking back, I must have caused poor little John Ray some pain because he was barefoot, didn't have any shoes on, just his pajamas, and she said, I took off running as hard as I could, dragging him along behind me. I don't know if you remember that or not, John Ray. She said she thought about that later, that she must have made him suffer. Anyway, she went back to living with her mom after all this. But there was a lot of fear. They were scared to go anywhere because buses were getting... Yeah, there was just a lot of killing. And they would sleep outside at night. For 2 years, these people slept out in the woods at night because of... That's when the guerrillas would come in and go into houses and take people and slaughter them, kill them. And I asked, why did they come at night? And I asked different people that, and I always got the same answer. It says, because it was people we knew. They didn't want us to see who they were. So it was the local people destroying the local people. How crazy is that? It was hatred, jealousy, whatever. And it was around that time that the kidnapping started, people disappearing, and at that time they started taking girls. Two girls that were members there were kidnapped, Candelaria's daughters, and they were the same age as Emiliana. And when Emiliana heard that, it just about did her, and it scared her so bad because these were her good friends. And there was no good reason for those people to kidnap girls. We all know that. Those girls were kidnapped. That family lost 5 people that night, and they have never been heard of since. And if I have time, I want to talk about them a little bit. But when things really got bad for the church in Palma was after the war was supposed to be almost over. The military general, he kicked the president out and took over, and he supposedly put an end to this war. He put out a proclamation that anybody that was out there living as a guerrilla, if they would come turn in their arms, there would be no penalty. They would integrate them back into normal life, and it worked on a fairly large scale. There were still these rogue groups out circulating and trying to gain control. And so the government said that every village all around the authorities had to establish what they called the local civil patrol. And what that was is at night they would put people on turns to walk around and try to see if there's any movement out there and keep guerrillas from infiltrating the villages. Well, do you know what? The very people that were put in control of that were the guerrillas. They were the ones that were fighting the government. And so that is when the church started to face severe persecution, because they were the local people and they knew that the Christians would not join with them But now they had the authority of the government to make them go out, required every able-bodied man to go out and serve. And they said, we weren't able to get them to join our ranks before, but now we'll force them to do what we want to do. And that is when things got really bad for the church. And Emiliana says that here they thought things had calmed down for a while, and suddenly her husband was an enemy to the community. They had just been married, not very long, and her husband was put on as the secretary or something for the community, and he would not take the job. And there were lots of meetings and people screaming at them. Alejandro said it was just the mob spirit, and he remembers standing there and people throwing dirt clods and screaming. And if you don't know the culture, you don't really know what this means to be told this. But the women even were hollering and saying, if you don't want to be a man, why don't you put on the cortes, the skirts that we wear, and be a woman if you're going to act like a woman? And that's a real slam to a man in that culture. And what could they do? Finally, they went to the Army General and said, we'll do alternative service. And they set up with the General to do that was fine. And they have a book of keeping track of all the things that they did during that time. And I actually have some copies at home of some of the things they did in that book. It's very interesting to read through there. But the authorities in their village were not happy with that. That was not what they wanted. They wanted to destroy these Christians. That was their goal, to get rid of them. And so they used some more subtlety and whatever to try to get rid of these people. They went to a lawyer and a judge, and they had this document drawn up that all these men, and they put the names of all the men that were in the church there, are part of a guerrilla movement, and Titus Miller is their head man. He's their commander, and he is bringing guns in from the United States and training these men how to fight. Okay, so they had this document. And then one Sunday morning, they went back into this village where people can't read or write. They can sign their names. They went to the Catholic Church and they said, we're the authorities of the community and we're trying to better our schools, and we have this paper here. We're requesting the government to give us pencils and erasers and notebooks and all kinds of things for a school, and we'd need your signatures to help out with this. And so people just signed this paper. They went over to another church and did the same thing. They got 1,000 signatures on that document, and they took it out to the military and showed it to them. And there was this force called the G2 force. They were a government. They were government snipers. And this document was handed over to them, and they were supposed to go back in and pick off all these people. Well, the commander thought something was a little wrong. Something was a little fishy, and he didn't take it to that level right away. First, he went back. He said, I need to meet with you people. And so they went out and had a meeting, and they showed him their book that's signed by the Army General that they can do alternative work. And this commander says, well, I'm not going to have y'all killed. But he said, somebody will do it. He said, my advice to you is get out. Move out. Just get away from there. So what would you do in a situation like that? Where would you go? And the struggles. Why am I a part of a church that requires this? There were other evangelical churches that their men would go out and do whatever the government asked. Do we ever face anything like that? Sure we do. What do we do about it? Where do we go for help? So, yeah, let's move. Where do we go? I had to think of those verses in Hebrews 11. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith he sojourned in the land of promises in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city with its half foundations, whose builder and maker is God. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they went out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country, that is, in heavenly, wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. And so they decided to leave, but they didn't want anybody to know they were leaving. And you mothers, you wives, try to imagine a little bit how that would be. She had about two little children, and she was trying to pack up things that they could just take and run with to take care of her children. Leaving her house, now this house to you probably wouldn't look like a house. It was probably bare block walls and no appliances. Nothing, but it was home. It was home, and as Emiliana was telling me this, she was crying with the memory of it, how she was getting her things together to take her family out of there, and she couldn't even tell her sisters what she was doing because they told her she was stupid. She was crazy. Why was she listening to that church that these Americans had come in and established? They're just American ways, you know. She believed it was biblical, and that's why she was doing it. She was doing it because of faith and because of belief. But she was harassed with these questions. Why am I part of a church that believes this way? Why am I going through this? But her mind would always go back to that night when that gun was in her back, and she'd say, you know, God spared me then. Why didn't he take me then? I wouldn't have to face this now. There must be some reason why I'm still here. And so she went around the room gathering things out. And there were three families that put things on a truck. Alejandro drove truck for a man in another village, and he left them use a truck to go out. They loaded that truck at night and left at night and went out to the next village to spend the night because they were afraid of what the community would do. I can't put myself in that place, but can you imagine the stress, the strain, the fear, what it must have been like, but believing they were doing the right thing. And something else turned up. It was Easter weekend. And they never thought about that, but in Guatemala, on Easter weekend, there are no trucks supposed to run the highways on Saturday. It's shut down. The country's shut down. They never once thought about it. They left Friday night, spent the night in the next village. Saturday morning, they hit the road. Police pulled them over. Said, you can't go. You can't go. You're not allowed to be on the road. They sat there by that road about all day long, trying to convince him to let them just go. It's just 30 miles down the road, maybe not even that far. We're moving. Nope, can't do it. Finally, he left them go. They got down. They were going to Chimaltenango. They got there Saturday night late. They pulled the truck in behind the church house. And I'm not sure where they stayed that night. They went to church there the next morning. Monday morning early, they went to get the truck to get their things. Somebody had come in and stolen everything off the truck. They had nothing left. Nothing. Their clothes, everything's gone. What do you do? Later, they found a place to settle and start another church, which is in Tecpan. That's where we live. And after that, they went back into Palama to get the rest of their things out of their house. They thought they left their house secure. Went back to their house, somebody had broken the roof open and taken everything they had left in their house. And that was gone too. And me and Leona said, I didn't even care by then. She said, I just kind of laughed. I said, you know what? I don't care. We're happy. We're out of this danger. Let those people have it if they want to. I have my family. And they went on their way. That's just part of the story. They were willing to face that for the cause of Christ. What would you do in that situation? How would you respond? Could you respond that way? Could you thank God? Through this, they would. She said, and Alejandra said, but you know, through all this, we saw that God is big, God is great, He cares for His children, He never left us, He's faithful. How could they say that? I was so convicted sometimes I could hardly sit still with some of my unthankfulness. I wanted to mention Candelaria a little. Time is rolling on here. One night they came to her house. They took her husband and four of her children, kidnapped and disappeared. These were masked men. Didn't know who they were. They had to be local people because they called the people out by name. The girls and said, "Come out of the house. Come out of the house." And they told the man, Pedro was his name, to hand over his gun. He said, "I don't have a gun. I'm a Christian. I don't fight." And they kicked him in the belly for saying that. He was all hunched over from pain. They tied up his hands. That's the last she saw him. The last she ever heard about him. She's been a widow ever since then. Lived by herself. Very few means. Worked hard. And I asked her to give her testimony of how she feels God has helped her since the time that her family disappeared. She said, "God has always been faithful in providing for my needs. There were times when I didn't know when the next meal would come, where I would get the next meal, where I would get money to go to market and buy food for the week. Market's once a week, Thursday. You buy food for a week at a time." She said, "I didn't have any money." She said, "I especially remember one Wednesday. Next day was market day. I had no money and I had no food in the house. I didn't know what I was going to do." She said about 6 o'clock market morning, somebody knocked on her gate. And she went, and here's this man. He says, "I'm sorry I didn't pay you sooner. I owe you money." And gave her 50 quetzales, and she has no clue. She didn't know he owed her the money. But she said that was the money she needed for that week. Another time, somebody knocked the door, she went out, there's a bag of corn sitting there for her tortillas. She doesn't know who it was. She said the Lord, she never went totally hungry. There was always something. Those people know the meaning of the verse, "If you have food and raiment, be content." How many of you here just have food and raiment? I don't believe there's a one of us that just have food and raiment. And how often are we discontent? Another thing that I learned during one of my trips down there for interview about this dear lady, this dear sister in the church. When we lived there in Tecpan, every year, it was right around harvest time, this Candelaria would ask to have a special Thanksgiving service at her home. And I kind of grumbled about it a few times. We went to church minimum of 3 times a week and often 5 times a week down there with all the involvement we had. And you know, sometimes you get to feel a little churched out. And I'd say, "Oh, another service, you know, do we really need to?" She wanted a service in her home, and then she would serve a meal. And I don't know where she got the means to do that. She would invite the whole church in there, serve a meal, have a little worship service, a little topic, somebody would give a little topic on Thanksgiving. And we would spend some time singing, and then she'd serve everybody lunch. I kind of grumbled about it different times, and I think I influenced my family to do the same a few times. And one of the last times I was down there, I found out that that service was on the anniversary of her family being kidnapped, and she's thanking the Lord for preserving her to this time. I was so ashamed. Can you imagine when she walks into heaven, reunited with her husband? "Not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. I know both how to be abased and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ which strengthens me. But my God shall supply all your need according to His riches and glory by Christ Jesus. Do we believe those verses? Can we live by those verses? 10 weeks later, after she lost her family, she went to live with her son that lived in another village, and 10 weeks later they came for him. He was the deacon in the church in Poughkeep. His name was Tomas. And they came that night for some reason. The Guatemalans tend to have a kitchen house and they have their living house. They cook over fire. These people would have had a fire in the ground, on the ground, and that's what they cooked over. No stove or anything. They had stayed in the kitchen that night, and next thing they were surrounded. Probably 20, minimum of 20 men. They don't really know. It was kind of a cold, rainy night. And they came in and they burst into the living quarters first because they thought the family would be in bed, and they weren't. And they come busting into the kitchen and here's the whole family sitting around the fire. Antonia is still living. That's the widow of this Tomas. And I talked with her. She told me her story, how they came and took her husband. He could have run. He could have got out of there. He chose not to. They came in, tied him up, treated. She was expecting a child before long. They kicked her out on the floor. Told her to be quiet, not make a sound. One man had a knife at her throat for a while, said, if you make any sound, you're dead. They took him, tied him up, took him outside. Cold, rainy night, no roof. Tied him to a post out there with his hands behind his back, and he called to her and said, would you bring me my jacket? It's cold out here. So she asked if she could take a jacket out to him, and they left her do it. And she says she remembers walking out there and seeing him hunkered down. Not only that, one of the men took his shoes off and threw them over his shoulder to use lighter. So he's barefoot in the cold and rain, and they came in and ransacked the house. And then they told her, don't worry, we're just taking him out for a little bit. He'll come back in a couple days. He had heard them talking. He knew what they were going to do. He told her, he says, he called her Tona. He says, Tona, don't wait for me. I won't be back. I will not be back. And as they were getting ready to leave, I have to cut this story short. As they were getting ready to leave, he asked them if he could tell his family goodbye. And they allowed him to do that. And she says she remembers he walked in there, his hands were behind his back, and he was barefoot. He was all cold and miserable, and he came in there. And he says, Tona, I won't be back. Their children were 8 and 6 and 2, and they were expecting the fourth one. And he said, you live for the Lord and bring these children up to know the Lord. Because I won't be here. And he told her goodbye and left. And he hasn't been back. She has not been faithful. I told her when we were leaving, I said, Antonia, I'm really glad you told me your story. It was a blessing to me to hear it. But I said, I would like you to remember the last words of your husband and go back to Christ. And she says, thank you. I asked her if she ever heard what happened to her husband. She said, the stories come back. They never know if they're true. But it was the common thing. They took him just a little ways away. They made him dig his own grave, and then they dispatched him with an axe, buried him, and she believes that's where he is. She doesn't know. I want to read. I was going to say at the beginning when I traveled to have these interviews. Samuel Kuhn from Farmington, New Mexico traveled with me. He's actually writing a book on this. It's being written right now. It will be in English and Spanish. But after one of our trips down there, it was after we had interviewed this Antonia. He wrote a little piece. He's a writer. He can write faster than I can think. But I really like this piece he wrote. He titled it Revolution. He said, 1979, Mr. Fidel Castro helped arm Mayans and other Guatemalans. Mr. Castro's doctrine told these impoverished people that they had been wronged and thus had a right to kill their wealthier neighbors in order to gain freedom and justice for all. The CIA-backed Guatemalan government responded by torturing and murdering the guerrillas. It was war. High in the mountains of Guatemala lived Tomas Salvador and his family. Tomas did not side with the guerrillas or with the government. Instead, he chose to side with Commander Jesus Christ, the one who teaches us to love all our enemies and treat them well. One day, in May of 1982, 20 guerrillas arrived at Tomas' house. As the guerrillas prepared to take Tomas away with them, he told his wife, Antonia, raise our children for the Lord. Then they took Tomas away. Months later, word filtered back to Antonia that the guerrillas had forced Tomas to dig his own grave in an arroyo not far away from the house, and they had dispatched him with the blow of an axe in the back of the head with an axe. In the midst of all the anger and hatred of revolution in Guatemala in the 80s, why did Tomas and other Christians like him choose to meekly suffer and die rather than take up weapons to save their lives? Because they were part of another revolution, Jesus Christ's revolution. He came to preach the gospel to the poor, to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to captives, to set at liberty them that are bruised. And Jesus Christ is still sending his followers out to preach this revolutionary doctrine all over the world. A few minutes after Tomas finished digging his grave, he went home. Home to be with his commander, forever. Home where there are no graves, no death, and no suffering. There, Tomas Salvador is alive and free. Justice and peace are his for all eternity by the authority of his almighty commander. Whether in Cuba, or in Guatemala, or in the USA, or any other country in the world, Christ's revolutionary truths are silently but powerfully triumphing over all other revolutions. Which revolution are you a part of? Who is your commander? Revelation 7:13-17 says, And one of the elders answered, saying unto me, What are these which are arrayed in white robes, and whence came they? And I said unto him, Sir, thou knowest. And he said to me, These are they which came out of great tribulation, and have washed their robes, and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore are they before the throne of God, and serve him day and night in his temple. And he that sitteth on the throne shall dwell among them. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more, neither shall the sun light on them, nor any heat. For the Lamb which is in the midst of the throne shall feed them, and shall lead them unto living fountains of water, and God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. Revelation 21:4, And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. And verse 8 says, But the fearful and the unbelieving and the abominable and murderers and whoremongers and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. I'm glad that I can look forward to that time when there will be no more tears, but I just can't imagine the joy Tomas felt when he walked in the presence of God. Thank you for your attention.